Ten Commandments this morning, and got some preliminary things to say. First of all, it helps, I think, when we talk about the Ten Commandments, if we realize we're maybe not as sophisticated as we think we are. That is to say that my general mindset is that as a Western civilized person, listening to Bach and riding in Oldsmobiles and everything, we certainly must be, or we certainly are, sophisticated and well along in our cultural development and personal development. And that looking back, therefore, to the Ten Commandments is kind of an interesting historical journey backwards. And as I was preparing for this, I was aware of that prejudice that I had, thinking, after all, that we were rather well educated and rather civilized, after all. And that primitive peoples, I mean, you know, peoples who had to kill cattle and burn them on an altar to make God happy, and primitive folks like Israelites and all those old-fashioned folks certainly needed stuff like this. But those of us who are more sophisticated and have psychiatrists and everybody to help us out, well, you know, we don't need them quite the same way that those old-fashioned folks needed these things. Well, so try to set that prejudice, that kind of cultural sophistication aside for a minute, and let's realize that we really are kind of gross, primitive people, okay? And what holds the fabric of our society together are the fine threads of the Ten Commandments, like any culture. The Ten Commandments have been called the Magna Carta of civilization, which is to say that when they are not followed, all hell breaks loose in no uncertain terms. I was trying to think about Anne here this morning, and I was thinking about if this were an Orthodox Jewish retreat center, and I was the only Christian, let's just say that Anne was the Orthodox Jew here, but let's just say Holden was an Orthodox Jewish retreat center, and there's all sorts of discussions all the time about everything you could possibly imagine, and one of the hours out of the year they decided to talk about Jesus for an hour. And so, as a Christian, I'd go and say, at the beginning of the discussion, "You mean you're going to give Jesus 1 hour out of the whole year?" They say, "Yeah, that's enough, right? That'll do." I say, "Wait a second. There's a whole lot more to talk about than you can't fit Jesus into an hour." Well, we're talking about the foundation stones of civilization, the Ten Commandments. And we're going to do that in an hour. Okay, that's really presumptuous and ridiculous and nonsensical, in a way. But that's what we're going to try. And so it's appropriate that we realize that we are, first of all, not very sophisticated, that we're as barbaric as anybody. And secondly, as anyone has ever been. And secondly, that these 10 simple statements, 10 commandments, are much bigger than we'll ever know. Okay, those are some preliminary statements. I've got a few more. I grew up in a Scandinavian home where one of the cardinal sins, one of the biggest things you could do wrong was to dance. And Barbie Campbell was a Catholic, and she danced, and I used to like to take her to the Valentine's Day parties at the school, and that was always a problem because dancing wasn't a good thing to do. Because, as our pastor Larson used to say, it really is simply vertical intercourse. You know, I mean, you just that's what he used to say. Yeah, you go ahead. See. Horizontal intercourse, well, that's kind of normal, you know, but standing up and doing it to music, that's abnormal. So anyway, And that was that whole thing kind of came out of Ten Commandments and a lot of other places. And I look back and I respect it and understand why they said some of the things that they said. But it gave me a notion of the Ten Commandments that are of the laws of God that were a little distorted. I'm going to try to correct some of that this morning and offer some new ways of seeing the Ten Commandments. God is sometimes, in searching for analogies, we refer to God as the life ring. When you fall overboard in a ship, what do they throw? Lifesaver. The round ring thing with the rope on it, and they throw it to you. And that's a good analogy for God. And so when you're drowning at sea, you get this thing, and they pull you in, and you finally get to shore. And the question is, now that you're on shore, what do you do with the life ring? I mean, you wear it around on the beach. What do you do with the object that's rescued you? Okay, let's just say that the Ten Commandments are the rescue. Okay, they are the life ring, but that's an incomplete analogy because they're also more than that. They are something that we use on the beach and on the shore as well. It's not something just to get us out of the water, just to save us from trouble, but rather as guides for our whole life, not just for immediate and present difficulty. In Jesus' day, the simple Ten Commandments had become just absolutely ridiculous. There were 1,521 laws just on Sabbath observance, just on Saturday observance. There was simply no way that Israel could make sense of the law, that they could even dig through the crust. It was barnacles galore, and to dig through that crust of the law was an immense job. And that's really what Jesus did in a way. He scaled it down and cleaned it up. Reading some examples from Leviticus 11. By the way, I should have told you that you'll all need Bibles this morning. Shall we just stop for a minute and make sure everybody has them? Yeah, let's do that. Leviticus 11.
Oh, this chapter. This chapter is one non-Orthodox.
Okay. What? This is just a small part of what the law had become. 11. Say to the people of Israel, these are the living things which you may eat among all the beasts that are on earth. Whatever parts the hoof and is cloven-footed and chews the cud among the animals you may eat. Nevertheless, those that chew the cud or part the hoof, you shall not eat these, the camel, because it chews the cud, but does not part the hoof and is unclean to you, the rock badger, because it chews the cud and does not part the hoof, the hare, because it chews the cud and does not part the hoof, the swine, because it parts the hoof and doesn't chew the cud, or something like that. These you may eat, things from the waters, and please notice over in 13, these will be an abomination to you, the eagle, the vulture, the osprey, the kite, the falcon, the raven, ostrich, nighthawk, seagull, hawk, owl, cormorant, ibis, water hen, pelican, carrion, vulture, stork, heron, whoopee, and the bat. All right? Please.
I took a history of medicine course, and the professor there said that this was in here as kind of a public health
exactly
record. Like, you know.
That's right. It is a public health record. And further on, they will, the next chapters will talk about unclean bodily discharges and how to clean up after them. Okay? All of that is helpful to keep a culture clean. All right? The laws go on and on through 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 is the one about unclean bodily discharges. In 16, there's more about rites of atonement. 17 and 18, let's just, you can just stop anywhere. Let's look at 18. This is about who you can and cannot have sexual relations with. Let's look at 18:6. None of you shall approach anyone near of kin to whom, to him to uncover nakedness. I am the Lord. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father, which is the nakedness of your mother. She is your mother, and you shall not uncover her nakedness. And you shall not uncover the nakedness, that means have sex with, by the way. Your father's wife, it is your father's nakedness. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your sister, the daughter of your father, or the daughter of your mother. 10. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your son's daughter or your daughter's daughter, for their nakedness is your own. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father. It goes on and on and on and on and on about what you cannot do and what you can do. Okay. What Jesus, we'll go, if you want to read that sometime, just... It just goes on infinitely, but that's only the tip of the iceberg. In addition to this, now that we have in Leviticus, there is the much more specific rules that we have in the what's it called, Dan? The Talmud.
That was Torah and the Talmud.
Right. The Talmud was a collection of laws. So, for example, about how to observe Saturday the Sabbath, when in Jesus' day. There were 1,521 specific laws about what you could and could not do on the Sabbath. How much you could carry, the weight of 2 chicken eggs was okay, but the weight of 3 chicken eggs was too much to carry. So this is what Jesus came to. What I'm asking you to do is to see that when the law was given, when the Ten Commandments was given, it through the centuries became a burden of immense weight, and that Jesus has set us free from that, but has not eliminated the law. Okay. So now I want to look. I made 3 simple drawings that I will try to explain, and then what we'll do is to refer to them frequently. We're calling this... The Ten Commandments are also called the Decalogue. They're written in Exodus 20 and in Deuteronomy 5. We're going to look at that in just a moment. I'm calling this session Promise and Exposure. The Ten Commandments are promise, and they are also an exposure of our sinfulness. 3 uses of the law. 3 uses of the Ten Commandments. The first I've pictured here using Mount Sinai, and God on the mountain gives to the people down here promise and order. First use of the law is the gift of promise and order. Second use of the law is to drive me to grace. I am climbing the mountain. First, God comes from the mountain to me. But I use the law now. I try to carry it up the mountain, carry the Ten Commandments and all the 1,521 laws up the mountain in order to meet my God on the mountain. Okay? All the while, from the mountain, God is lovingly and gently asking the question, how you doing? Okay? God is asking from the mountains, are you making it? God's not asking a sarcastic question. He's simply asking, are you making it? Okay? As you try to climb the mountain. The analogies of the mountain, of course, is because I've chosen the Sinai pictures here because that's the picture, that's the place in which the Ten Commandments were originally given. We're going to explain each one in more detail. The third use of the law I call, let's make a deal. Who's the host of that?
Bob Barker.
Who? Bob Barker?
Monty Hall.
Yeah, Monty Hall. Let's make a deal. Come on down, they say, or something like that. Oh, Christ. Okay. Here is the scale, and the scale indicates that that we're trying to make a deal with God, and the deal we're making is that if we obey the commandments, then the promise and the love of God will be given to us. Okay. If you're nice, God will love you. If you're naughty, God won't like you. Okay. That's the let's make a deal thing. Okay. Each, there are three separate and distinct ways of looking at the law, and we have to look at each one. I'd like you to turn, please, to Exodus 20, actually Exodus 19. Exodus 19. And we have to read now, all right? The scene is Mount Sinai, and the characters are God, Moses, and a crowd, all right? On the third new moon, after the people of Israel had gone forth out of the land of Egypt, on that day they came into the wilderness of Sinai, and when they set out from Rephidim and came into the wilderness of Sinai, they encamped in the wilderness, and there Israel encamped before the mountain. Moses went up to God, and the Lord called him to him out of the mountain, saying, Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the people of Israel, Ye have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings, and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will obey my voice, and keep my covenant, you shall be my own possession among all peoples. For all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the people of Israel. God starts out by saying, I did good, huh, Moses? That's the first word here. How am I doing, he says. God says to Moses, you like it so far? Did I bear you like an eagle on eagle's wings? I took you out of slavery, did I not? Right, okay. Let's smile when we read this, okay? We've got to hear the loving Father. All right. This is not a cold-blooded Swede talking. This is a hot-blooded Hebrew, okay? Who's in a pant for us, okay? Wait a minute, Dan says. This is true. This is a hot-blooded Hebrew just dying for us to respond, okay? So it starts out by this hot-blooded Hebrew God saying, I did good, huh? Okay? That's what it says. I think it does. Sure it does. 7. So Moses came and he called the elders of the people and he set before them all these words which the Lord had commanded him. And all the people answered together and said, All that the Lord has spoken we will do. And Moses reported the words of the people to the Lord. Went back up the hill and said, Yeah, they said that's a good deal. They'll do it. 9. And the Lord then said to Moses, Okay, I'm coming to you in a thick cloud that the people may hear when I speak with you and may also believe you forever. Then Moses told the words of the people to the Lord. And the Lord said to Moses, Go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow, and let them wash their garments, and be ready by the third day, for on the third day the Lord will come down upon Mount Sinai in the sight of all people, and you shall set bounds for the people round about, saying, Take heed that you do not go up to the mountain, or touch a border of it. Whoever touches the mountain will be put to death. No hand shall touch him, but he shall be stoned or shot to death with arrows, whether beast or man, he shall not live. When the trumpet sounds a long blast, they shall come up to the mountain, but not too far, right? You go up. In other words, he said, we're going to have a great big assembly, but you have to put up a chicken wire fence around Sinai here. And it only goes so far. If anybody goes over the fence and in up too close to me, then they have to be killed, because you keep your distance from the holy God. And come on up when you hear the trumpet sound. 14. So Moses went down to the mountain to the people, consecrated the people, and he washed their garments, and he said to the people, Be ready on the third day, do not go near a woman. Okay? Part of ritual cleanness, in addition to taking baths, was refraining from any sexual intercourse. So that's what it says. Don't go near a woman. That purity is you take a bath, and then no sex, and you're ready for the meeting of God on the mountain. 16. On the morning of the third day, there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud upon the mountains and a very loud trumpet blast, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled. I mean, really, you took a bath, right? You had no sex for 3 days. And now the trumpet starts to blast from out of the mountain, and it's just tremendous. And there's smoke and there's fire and everything's roaring at once here. Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they took their stand at the foot of the mountain. And Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire, and the smoke of it went up like the smoke of a kiln, and the whole mountain quaked greatly. And as the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him in thunder. And the Lord came down upon Sinai to the top of the mountain, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. And the Lord said to Moses, "Go down and warn the people, lest they break through to the Lord to gaze, and many of them perish. And also let the priests who come near to the Lord consecrate themselves, lest the Lord break out upon them." And Moses said to the Lord, "The people cannot come up to the mountain, for I put a chicken wire fence around here." See? "For thou thyself didst charge us, saying, set bounds upon the mountain and consecrate it." And the Lord said to him, "Go down and come up, bringing Aaron with you. Do not let the priests and the people break through to come to the Lord, lest he break out against them." So Moses went down, and he told to the people, and he told them. In other words, grimace. Not too close. Now, what is told? "And God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage." Commandment number one. Now, we don't know if the next is commandment number two or a continuation of one. If you're in the Reformed tradition, you call the next statement commandment two. If you're a Lutheran, you call it a continuation of number one. All right? So there, what we'll do probably here is just stay with what some of us have learned early on, and that verse three, "You shall have no other gods before me," is a part of commandment number one. All right? Next commandment. "You shall not make for yourself a graven image or any likeness." Oh, this is all still a part of one. "Or anything that is heaven above, or in the earth beneath, or that is in the water beneath the earth, you shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments." That long statement probably was not an original part of the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments, as they originally were given, probably are reflected in verses 13, 14, 15, 16. Simple, one sentence, declarative sentence, "You shall not," etc. Okay. Next commandment in 7. "You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain." 8. "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you will..." Now, this explanation of the Sabbath is probably not original. The original form of the commandments did not have long explanations with them. That's what I meant by it. The original form were real probably tight and very clean and simple. 7th day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. "In it you shall not do any work, you or any of your sons or your daughters or manservants, maidservants, cattle, sojourner within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the 7th day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land which the Lord your God gives you. You shall not kill. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or manservant, maidservant, or his ox or his ass or anything that is your neighbor's." Now, 17 there. The Lutheran tradition and the Catholic tradition indicates that verse 17 is the 9th and the 10th commandment. The Reformed tradition says that 17 is the 10th commandment. You follow the difference there?
But the Reformed are right.
Fine.
Damn.
Okay. Now please notice that the story of the smoke and the fire and the fence that the people are not supposed to cross continues. The Ten Commandments appear to be kind of an insertion here in the story, but they fit, obviously, at this point in the story. Now, notice, please, in 18. "Now when the people perceived the thunderings and the lightnings and the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking, The people were afraid and trembled, and they stood afar off and said to Moses, "You speak to us, and we will hear. But let not God speak to us, lest we die." And Moses said to the people, "Do not fear, for God has come to prove you. And the fear of him may be before your eyes, that you may not sin." And the people stood afar off, while Moses drew near to the thick darkness where God was. And the Lord said to Moses, "Thus you shall say to the people of Israel, you have seen for yourselves that I have talked with you from heaven. You shall not make gods of silver to be with me, nor shall you make for yourselves gods of gold. An altar on earth you shall make," and this goes on to talk about altar, and then 21 goes on to, some more about some laws down there. This is the first place in which we have the Ten Commandments written. Let me real quickly just show you that where the second place is, and that is in Deuteronomy chapter 5. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers. Thank you. Deuteronomy 5. This is later on in the history of Israel now. This is the second time that the Ten Commandments are written. This is a review of what took place, starting in 5. "And Moses summoned all Israel and said to them, 'Hear, O Israel, the statutes and the ordinances which I speak in your hearing this day, and you shall learn them and be careful to do them. The Lord your God made a covenant with us in Horeb. Not with our fathers did the Lord make this covenant, but with us, who are all of us here alive this day. And the Lord spoke with you face to face at the mountain, out of the midst of the fire, while I stood between the Lord and you at that time to declare to you the word of the Lord. For you were afraid because of the fire, and you did not go up into the mountain. He said, 'I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me.'" And then the graven image again, in 8. 11, "You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain." That's the same. 12, "Observe the Sabbath." That goes on the same. 16, "Honor your father and your mother." Goes on. 17, "Kill." 18, "Adultery." 19, "Stealing." 20, "False witness." 21, "Coveting." "These words the Lord spoke to all your assembly at the mountain, out of the midst of the fire, the cloud, and the thick darkness, with a loud voice, and he added no more." Okay. We start up here, please, with picture number 1. Okay? The first commandment, I'm going to just say the name of the commandment, then you say them out loud this morning, okay? Commandment number 1, please. All right. Thank you. Do you like that, Chris? Commandment number 1, "I am the Lord your God." Commandment number 1 is not a commandment at all. Commandment number 1 is a declaration. It's a decision that God has made about us. God is not waiting for us to be sincere. God is not waiting for us to be religious, or to have a good theology, or to have an understanding of the nature of God or the church or whatever. The first commandment is not a commandment at all. It is a simple declaration. God is not hanging around in the stars waiting for us to perform. Rather, in baptism, God comes to us, chooses us, and says, "I am your God." The image, please, now not of a cold and aloof Scandinavian, but rather of a hot-blooded Hebrew who's just in a heat. "I am the Lord your God." You feel the difference between the two? Okay. God's all excited, and he comes and he announces it. "I am your God. I am your God." And he's all fired up about the whole idea. That's the way it starts. But now there is a problem. Because you and I are really two people. We're all schizophrenic. And this is a New Testament and an Old Testament idea. All of us have two personalities. The Bible calls them Old Adam and New Adam. We all have two parts to us. The Old Adam in us says, thank you, God, that's a nice idea, but I can do it myself. Thank you, it's a nice idea, but I'm not sure you really meant that promise for me. Thank you, it's a nice idea, but don't you think I should be sincere first before you want to be my God? The old Adam in us wants to take care of ourselves. The old Adam will say, will have us saying, now that I've made a decision for Jesus, then God certainly must want to keep his promise for me. Okay. The key words in the old Adam are me, myself, and I. So the old Adam, that one part of our schizophrenic personality, then chooses to send in idols to replace the God that has chosen us. Okay? And the idols are money and self and whatever else that you want to choose. Bonhoeffer said that when a pastor is done preaching a sermon or conducting a service on a Sunday, leading the Eucharist, the physical feeling that a pastor should have is not at all being tired, first of all. You should not be emotionally drained after a service. I want to tell you that on Sunday night after leading a service or any time, I am just shot. I really am. Have dessert and I want to go home. And Bonhoeffer says that is because of sinfulness. Because you're trusting your own self more than you trust God. All right. The old Adam in us says that unless Dan does a good job Sunday night, unless Dan is really well organized and gives a really good sermon, the whole thing is meaningless for us. Okay? Right? So Bonhoeffer says to Dan, he says, check how you feel after church on Sunday. You should feel absolutely normal. Before, that should be no difference. You should just move right through it, because if you trust God, you don't have to be nervous, you don't have to be uptight, and your adrenaline does not have to flow. But the old, miserable Bonhoeffer. But the old Adam in us says, the old Adam and Dan, that is, says that unless Dan does well, and all of that, unless his self is in the lead, the whole Eucharistic celebration will certainly be of second-rate quality. Okay? The old Adam in us wants to put ourselves in an important spot. The first commandment is a promise. It is saying, I'm your God. Don't you get it? I'm your God. The old Adam in us says, wait a minute. I'm not sure I want you. I'll do it myself. I'll leave the Eucharist myself. Thank you. Okay? I'm sure glad only Dan had that problem. The meaning of the cross is, in New Testament understanding, the meaning of the cross is that one half of our schizophrenic personality got nailed to the wood. All right? The cross is the old Adam killed. Baptism is the calling forth of the other half of our personality, the calling forth of the new Adam. Now, this calling forth of the new Adam in baptism is something that God does not ask us to do alone, because the assignment that is given is really a huge assignment. That is to be a new person, to be holy, to love God with all your heart and your mind and your soul. That's a hard job. So, not asking us to go it alone, God joins us in the task and the work it is that we have in being the new Adam. God calls out the best in us by granting faith in Christ. God calls out the best in us by affirmation. God calls out the best in us by wooing us like a lover. As I was wooing my Catholic friend Barbie Campbell at the Valentine's Day dance in eighth grade, I remember that the wooing of Barbie Campbell was done subtly and gently and secretively, so she'd get it, you know, and hopefully say, gee, Jim is a really nice guy. But certainly,
not to go up to Barbie Campbell in the hall in eighth grade and say, "You better like me." Eh? I mean, that doesn't work very well, anyway, as we woo our lovers. God woos us, not with a, "You better like me," but with a hot-blooded Hebrew subtlety, yes, of saying, hot subtlety, saying, "I'm your God." Okay? Now, let's see the Ten Commandments. Then, not as let's see the Ten Commandments here as God coming to us, to the people, to give the promise of his love and to give us order. The first purpose of the law, the first purpose of the giving of the law, is to create order so we can hear the promise. All right? Order so we can hear the promise. If there's chaos in school, we can learn nothing. Right? Is this true? If there's chaos in the study halls or in the classroom, there is no way to learn a thing. What the Ten Commandments does, in part, is to create an order. If we were forever worried about whether you're going to stab me in the back and get away with it, if I was forever worried about whether or not you were going to steal everything I owned, family possessions and all, if I was forever worried about everything, if there was no order, if it was just one big Iran, the whole world was a big Khomeini fair, see? We can't stand that. I mean, it's simply impossible to live this way. You know, like in a Werner said at breakfast this morning, he said, it was about Cambodia. He said, you know, you realize that when the United States government has nobody to call on the telephone, there's no one to call in Cambodia. There's no one to give the food to. There's no government. Everything is just chaos. Werner said that made him think a little differently about what Paul said in Romans 13. Governments are given by God. Order is given by God. Maybe an evil government, maybe a good government. But at least there's somebody to call on the telephone and say, "We've got $60 million worth of groceries here in the United States we want to give you in Cambodia." Can't do that in this situation because there's no one to call on the phone. No ambassadors, there's no nothing. The first gift of the law is order so that we can be safe here together. That the whole hall of civilization can happen, therefore. And when we are safe, then there's a chance to hear the promise. Okay? A chance to hear the promise. Now, the second purpose of the law is to drive us to the promise. Because the old Adam in us does not want to live in the promise. The old Adam in us wants to climb the mountain all by myself. And you've gone up Martin Ridge or someplace and someone offers to carry your pack? Hey, I can do it. You know, right? I mean, I went up, where was it? I was with Peter and David and last spring, and we were going up Martin Ridge in the snow with full packs, and Jim Smith stopped and came back and offered to take a part of, either take my sleeping bag or take a part of it. And I was just dying. I mean, I was just dying. It was awful. It was just going straight up the snow fields, you know, and hot, and it was just tough. But there's no way Jim Smith was going to carry my sleeping bag. The old Adam in us says, "I can do it. I can make it. I can climb it." And that's what's going on here. The second purpose of the law is God's very gently speaking to us saying, "Are you making it? How you doing? Are you getting there?" And of course, it's kind of a haunting voice. Because the haunting voice says, are you obeying all my commandments? Are you being righteous? Do you have any idols? Have you hurt anybody? Does the amount of food you eat contribute to anyone else's death in the world? Right? Those are haunting questions. Do the products we buy from South Africa mean that we're killing somebody in South Africa because we buy those products? Yes, it does. It's a very direct relationship. Okay. And those are haunting questions. God's simply quietly asking, how are you doing? Are you making it up? Now, the last use of the law is the old Adam giving it one last try. The old Adam comes to us, and that schizophrenic part of us, the old Adam part of us, comes to us and says, say, you know what these Ten Commandments are? They're a really good deal. If you do those, God will love you. Okay? The old Adam in us says, hey, the commandments are so that you and God can make a deal. Come on, let's make a deal with God right now. Let's obey all the commandments, and then God will give you the promise. That's the last attempt that the old Adam has in us, to confuse the order of things. Because the order of things is promise first, then our response. But what happens over here is that the order gets turned around, you see. The promise will be given if you obey all the commandments, if you make a decision, if you are sincere, if what? Right? And this is the most subtle one of all, the most subtle thing that the old Adam does in us. He comes to us and says, well, sure, God loves you, if. Okay? That's the most subtle one of all. Let's look at the Ten Commandments as promise. Let's look at them as promise here. This is pure grace. Any idea that there's not grace in the Old Testament is not true. The Old Testament is chock full of grace. All right? God's unmerited love and goodness to us. The first commandment, looked at as promise, simply says, I'm yours. We've already talked. It's the hot-blooded Hebrew saying, hey, guess what? We're friends. Okay. The second commandment, as promise, is call me anytime you want. You've got my name. Name in Hebrew, of course, in ancient civilizations, knowing your name meant you had control, power. It was a relationship. If I didn't know your name, there was nothing going on between us. If I knew your name, we had something going. I could ask you for things. You could ask me for things. It was a very important transaction when I learned your name. Okay. God says, here's my name. Anytime, you just call me up. Anytime you want.
What is that commandment?
Well, we're going by the Lutheran order. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Okay? Third one. Remember the Sabbath day. Promise. God is saying, take a rest now. Okay? That's it. Okay? See the grace in it? You worked hard enough. Just take the day off. You've got to have some rest once in a while. Right? And that the kind of rest that God offers, suggests to us, directs us here, is to say, yes, don't work. In other words, put the plow away. Don't do dishes. Don't do the laundry. Do as little as you can. Truly sit down in the big chair. In addition, though, the most restful rest you're going to get is if you're being refreshed by my word. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Not just to take the day off and to stay home and watch the Vikings. That's okay, and that's a part of it. But true refreshment is refreshment that's a meditative, spiritual word refreshment. Okay? That's a part of it also. But basically, it's God saying, take the rest of the day off. Take the rest of the week off. All right? Fourth commandment, honor father and mother. It's God saying, you need someone to cuddle you. Okay? You need someone to hold you. Someone, you need a lap to sit in. You do. You need somebody to go to when it hurts. You need father and mother. Okay? You hear the warmth of the loving father saying, you know, I know what you need. You need somebody to be at home with. You need some love. Okay? What else do we need? Fifth commandment. You don't need to get hurt. Right? See the grace there? You don't like to get beat up, knocked down in the playground, or shot in the head with a .32. You need to be bodily safe. I know you need that, God says. So, that one. The next one. God says, I know that you need intimacy, and that you need conversation, and that if there are children in the world, those children will be happier, most well protected, if there is a stable family. Adultery doesn't work. Because you're going to get hurt by it. Someone's going to get hurt. Kids are going to get hurt, or that you're going to get hurt, or somebody's going to get hurt. So don't do that. Because it won't be any fun. You're going to get hurt by it. The next commandment says, and all the last five commandments are all about living at Holden Village. See, they're all about community. You can't live in community if you're forever worried about being somebody beating you in the head, you know, knocking you over the head with something. You can't live in community if you're always afraid, if I'm always afraid that somebody in this village is going to try to seduce my wife. I mean, it's hard. You know? I mean, it just rips the place apart. Another need for community is that we don't have to forever lock our doors. Don't steal. Why? Because if you fret over your plow and over your money, and if you're forever locking everything up all the time, I mean, it just makes things difficult, right? Hear the grace there and the concern God has for us in our community. Another thing that we're going to need is a good reputation. With a bad reputation, you can't go to Chelan and you can't do anything. If you don't have a name, you can't get a checking account, you can't get credit cards, you can't get anything. You can't borrow money. What can you do with a bad name? But with a good name, you can do everything. So community is established by good names. And God says, I know you need a good name. God says in the second commandment, I need a good name. Right? I mean, I value my reputation. And I know you need your reputation also. Okay? Hear the promises. And then in 9 and 10 about coveting property and everything else, it's the same thing. That if we're forever suspicious of each other, stealing our stuff and stealing the essential relationships of our life, that's what last commandment's about. If we're forever worried about how you're going to steal either my family or everything that I've got, then community can't work. Okay, are the Ten Commandments law? They're not law. First of all. The Ten Commandments are simply grace. They are the Magna Carta of civilization. They are God saying, this will make it work. Okay. Now I want you to think about how we are so sophisticated here in America. You know, that we don't need these laws like ancient civilizations. We don't need these loving guidelines, this grace like ancient civilizations needed, because we're more sophisticated than that. I don't necessarily believe that. In fact, I don't believe it. First of all, though, the Ten Commandments are grace.
But now, what happens is that God knows that we're not going to like it. God knows that we basically don't care for grace. God realizes that we have a schizophrenic old Adam in us. And so, since he knows there's a battle that's going to rage within us, God sets himself against the battle. And I know of no better way to say it. God sets himself against the battle by using those Ten Commandments, first as grace, but then as law. Okay? You will not kill each other. Okay? He sets himself against the battle that he knows will rage within us and within all of civilization. And then each of the commandments the second time around becomes law. You will not kill each other. That's it. You will not commit adultery. It ruins things. You will not steal each other's property. I don't care if you understand it or not. He says, that's the rule. If you don't like it, too bad. Because that's the way it's going to be. Okay? First, the whole commandments are grace. And then, to set himself against the conflict he knows that's coming, he says, well, they're not going to listen to the love, but by golly, they might listen to the law. So, that's it. Gives the law the second time around. You will not do this. You will not do that. You will not da-da-da. Okay. But then the second time around is right here. God says we will not do certain things. And we try to do them, but we can't make it. We're driven back to grace. For we know we steal and we kill and we commit adultery and we have idols all over the place. We know we do it. We're driven back to grace. By a last attempt, we say, hey, how about let's make a deal? I'll do all those things, and then you give me the promise, which is kind of like the second one anyway. And that doesn't work either. The Ten Commandments as exposure. First commandment. We do have idols. What are our idols? We worship ourselves. We can, I mean, it's obvious. Right? I mean, we can worship ourselves. We can worship money. What can, I mean, the number of idols that we can choose and find to worship are immense. All the way, I mean, I would love a diesel Oldsmobile more than anything in the whole world. Wouldn't you like a diesel Oldsmobile? 30 miles to the gallon. I mean, quiet, go down the road just like a song with an 8-track stereo in it.
I have a friend that is miserable with his diesel.
I don't want to hear it. Not true. Not. Oh, is that right? Oh, no.
Can't get gas all the time.
A rabbit
carburetor never worked right.
Get a rabbit.
Rabbit diesel. No way. I want an old Oldsmobile diesel with velour seat. I don't want a. I had a rabbit. So, I feel like you're riding around with a miniature German tank.
Yeah.
Huh? Yeah. Well, that's what, yeah, right. Easy chair. Tilt seat.
Electric.
I love it. Well, all right. Expose. Let's let the commandments expose us. Expose the idols in number one. Second commandment. Let's about taking God's name in vain. Let's let that commandment expose the way in which we use God's name for our own profit, for our own pleasure, for our own fun, for our own enjoyment, to bless our own little activities, to make, to justify our own prejudices. Let's realize that lots of people use God's name in vain, and so do we. Okay, for our own ends. Remember the Sabbath day. Let that commandment expose our restlessness, that we have a very hard time sitting down, that we feel best when we're up working and trying to justify our existence by how hard we work. Let that commandment expose in us how we are more inclined to work for our salvation than to have it given to us. Honor father and mother. Let that commandment expose the tensions that are a part of our lives. That in some ways I hate my mother and my father. And in some ways they hate me. Let's let it expose the truth.
that we, that family relationships are heaven and they're hell. There is nothing worse than hating parents or being hated by them. Not just parents, but the tension between all of society, between governments and us. You know, more than just the family relationship. Let it expose all of that. Thou shalt not kill. Let that commandment expose the fact that that we watch television and are entertained by murder. And is there anything more obnoxious than that? Could there be anything more sick than watching, than being entertained by murder? Isn't that a strange thing? That we let ourselves do that. Don't commit adultery. Let that expose that we have sex with other people for our own entertainment. That that quickies are something we do for ourselves, and if it injures the other person, that's their problem, it's not ours. Stealing, let that expose the fact that if we can bargain with our neighbor and cheat our neighbor in the bargain, so be it. Let it expose the fact that in corporate life, if you can make a 19-cent a squirt gun in Hong Kong and sell it for $1.29 at Kresge's, you get a promotion. Right? That's true, isn't it? Okay? The more you can make, the bigger jobs you're going to get. Okay, let it expose that that stealing is a part of what getting ahead means. And that you and I are very adept at stealing in many different ways. Eighth commandment about, or the next commandment about bearing false witness, about lying about each other. Let it expose that we really do like to talk about each other. Bonhoeffer says that in life together, one of the things you will not do in this community at Finkenwalde is talk about each other, even under the guise of, well, we're just trying to figure out what's good for you. He says, no. But let that commandment expose the fact that one of the best recreations we ever come across, in addition to cross-country skiing, is gossip. I mean, it's fun, right? And it hurts other people. It's violent to talk, to injure another person's name, but we do it. Let the last commandment about coveting expose the fact that we really basically distrust everybody, especially the mechanic who's fixing the car. Let it expose the fact that I don't see anything wrong if I look at your wife, but you better not look at mine. That kind of possessiveness and distrust there, kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, I have a difficult time separating covetousness from stealing.
Similar.
It seems to be
sure
in the same.
It is.
Spirit.
Yes.
I wonder though if the opposite of coveting would be. Rejoicing with mm-hmm. your neighbor over,
yes.
over what
yes.
he has.
Yes.
Is coveting the same as envy?
Yes. I understand that in Hebrew, to covet something meant not only, boy, you really have a nice Oldsmobile, but I'm going to try to figure out how to get it. Yeah. It was more than just saying admiring your car. It was admiring it and planning. How shall I get it? Okay. The commandments are promise, they're grace. The commandments are secondly exposure of our own sinfulness. The purpose of that is to drive us to the promise, to drive us to grace. They are both promise and exposure. They are both grace, law and gospel. Now, I guess the question is, one of the questions, at least for the rest of the day and for tonight, is, are we sophisticated enough so that some of these truly do not apply to us any longer? Or is there something about the human condition that has nothing to do with the age in which you live? Is there something about us that we are, in one way, we are exactly like the Hebrews in their tents 2,000 years before Jesus? That the 4,000 years from then to now is nothing. I mean, we are the same folks. It was chariots then, it's Oldsmobiles now. It's the same thing. But we're really no more sophisticated now than then. And that that there's still the only way in which our own personal lives will hang together and the whole of civilization will hang together. Okay, I'm done. Yeah. Talk about where are we here?
Isn't there a use of the law that other Protestants have? Other Protestants have used that Lutyens of Old Scheidegans as guidelines to the life that responds to grace. Is that okay?
Yes, yeah.
Lutyens have always kind of hated that, haven't they?
I don't know. I was taught that in confirmation, but that's good, isn't it? Give an example.
Well, like the, if the gospel is promised and the Ten Commandments are also guidelines on how to live the life of response, but Lutherans have normally shied away from that use of a lot of things, traditionally.
That is to say that you don't kill anybody, not because you want to make God happy. You don't kill anybody because you're thankful for your salvation in Christ, and because of you're thankful for that, you consequently want to do the best you can. Right?
Then you go back to the Ten Commandments, right. Guidelines for that response.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I don't understand your third point. Let's make a deal. What? It kind of went right over my head. What are you getting at?
I'm getting at that. It's very similar to the second. It's another way, maybe even, of saying the second. It's saying that that is it's a revival preacher saying, if you accept Jesus as your Lord and Savior, then God will love you. If then. It is saying, if you do certain things, then the promise of grace will be given.
And not realizing that the promise is there first.
Yes. It places, correct.
It's a kind of work
it
idea.
Is. Yes,
isn't
it is.
I mean, if you do enough, then you'll be accepted by your
God. Yeah.
So if we outline all the things that we're willing to do to be Christian,
right.
Then maybe we'll make it into heaven.
Yeah.
The problem with that is that our feeble minds understand what that all about. We limit. Is that part of the old Adam then? Part that God says, you've got this, we don't want that. It just doesn't feel right. I mean, it doesn't feel right to me, Because they don't have to do anything, and you've got this huge gift. I don't want it. Like, I want to work for it or say,
The old Adam says to us, hey, look, the whole world works this way. I mean, you don't graduate from school unless you turn in your term papers, right? Well, what do you think? God's any different than the whole world? Come on.
That's why so many people I know have problems with the hell they're going to cross. Sure. Jesus, sure. Because my father used to be really angry about it. He said, does that mean he can live all his life doing exactly what he wants? And in the last minute, he can say, let me in, and God's going to do it.
Yeah.
Without question, what's behind it?
Yeah.
It says don't do it, you don't do it.
Right.
flow out of the Spirit, out of the Holy Spirit. And if the promise of the Holy Spirit is given to us, then, and if the Holy Spirit is living in me, I think at that point I no longer have to go looking somewhere else to see what I should be doing. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I'm warned that sin also is in me. Mm-hmm. And so then I think, you know, they're still there. I still am convicted from time to time of a sinful act. But I think when I'm in the Spirit, I don't need to refer to a guide. The Spirit is the guide.
Mm-hmm. Is it not a model to test against? I mean, it's not something that we would say, project and try to do that, first of all, but in knowing that we have the Spirit within us, when we are swaying from that, or when I am missing that, I look to other things to find an indicator of where, you know, when I am missing it, where I somewhat of a, like when you're making something on a lathe or something, you would have a model to go from. You have one piece that you're starting from. You compare to that and saying, I'm a little fat there, or whatever it would be, in a way that model, I take it in.
I was just thinking of when John was talking about Thomas Merton, how most prayer books make us feel like we want to be someone else other than who we are, rather than just feeling okay, you know, about who we are. And I don't know, maybe I've missed what you've been trying to say today, but the Ten Commandments still sound to me like be someone other than who you are. Well, maybe not.
I'm saying that.
Yeah.
In part.
Yeah. It makes it too easy if we just talk about the Ten Commandments.
Of course, that's why it's both promise and exposure.
That's why I really like the flip side of it. I've not thought about the Ten Commandments from the point of view of exposure and sinfulness. And to go through and get looking at that side of it.
Yeah. It just reveals who we are, all of it.
Yeah.
I think I can explain it's why Luther's small catechism starts with the Ten Commandments. So we'll be exposed, and then he goes to the creed. And is the word of grace. And he was almost totally in the exposures. So,
I think probably too, one reason why we might have trouble with the Ten Commandments is that these are given to a society, and they reflect, you know, that's too weak a word, society. They're given to a group of people whose whole identification is tied up with those and with who is giving them. And their leader, I mean, the man that they're following out of Egypt is the one who's the middleman in this mm-hmm. process. I mean, there's nothing outside. There's no television, movies, magazines, Eastern gurus, or anybody else to refer to if you don't dig this stuff. This
mm-hmm.
is it.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing else going on. I mean, we sit here, and I mean, if I don't like this, I can go to Wayne Dyer. I can watch television. I can read the New Yorker. There's lots of ways I can go.
The Egyptians.
Oh yeah. Okay. Right. But I'm talking about when this is happening. I mean, at the mountain. Okay. And I mean, we're trying to capture the feel of these things for what they are. Yeah. Yeah. Right. they experience the same problems. Right. Exactly. The Egyptians.
And the Canaanite gods, once
yeah.
they went into the promised land.
Yeah. Yeah. They want to fish around and look for other things, and so do we. And we say, oh, gee, we have so much trouble following this. Right.
Here's another analogy, which is a fish around. Sorry.
About taking the Lord's name in vain, what did that mean? I mean, nowadays we take it to mean, well, you don't say God damn.
Right.
It didn't mean that we don't get it.
Well, Jim said more.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Whether it's, one is to say, God damn it, that's taking the name Lord's name in vain.
You meant both of them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, just plain old, ordinary, garden variety of locker room swearing, you know. That's one way of taking the Lord's name in vain. Another way is kind of the righteous way of saying, the Lord wants you to give me all your money.
Kind of like what Dan said that his spirit says that thing.
Yeah.
Does.
Yeah. And cathedral.
Elect people.
Yeah, and no one left. Yeah.
Is there any other way that could be translated? I mean, has it been translated just taking it in vain? It doesn't seem to communicate that.
I think, you know, one thought I had on the taking in vain is that if you do something in vain, it's got no, it has no potency.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's a vain act is
yeah,
one
yeah.
in which
yes.
I don't see beyond the end of my nose, and it's got no power, it's got no potency to it. The Lord's name has to be a name with power.
Yeah.
And if I start throwing the Lord's name around all over the place, and there's no power and no vision associated with it, I've broken his commandment.
Yeah. So that when you're shooting pool or stub your toe and say, God damn it, it's a way of saying, what? You know, if you're so casual about that, then the ways in which God does judge us, you'll really miss them. And you shouldn't miss that, because God's judging us all the time. Yeah. The Hebrews, the ancient Hebrews, were so afraid of this commandment, taking the Lord's name in vain, that they developed other words for the word God. Saying God was against the rules. You could not say it. In fact, they dropped the syllables out. I mean, they forgot the syllables. So what they developed were code names. That's true. Yahweh.
Yeah.
Yahweh is a code. Everybody knows what it means, but it's not God's name. It's kind of like rutabaga. We all know what it means. It means G-O-D, but you can't say it. Yahweh, Elohim, Adonai. Those are three code words that Israel developed.
Yeah, they don't write them out in the Hebrew. They put just part of a vowel, and they don't nearly write the whole.
Right.
When I was learning to read it, I remember looking at that and thinking, well, what's that? And they said, I don't know. And I said, you know, and they said, well, you don't write it out.
Right.
You know, and they still don't.